Right, so Joyce has already asked me if this is going to be really scientific. There is some science in it. I will leave time for questions at the end, but if people have got questions as we go, I'm very happy to take them as we go, if there's anything that I can explain. A number of people have sent through questions already, which is really helpful, so I'll try and answer this as I go along. Some people have sent me some articles and some links, which have been helpful as well, so thank you for that. And a few people have contacted me over the last few days just to encourage me, so that's been good as well. So I've just put my letters up there, just because I think in this day and age particularly, you just need to know people's background and where they're coming from when they're speaking about things. So I'm a medical doctor, that's what the first bit means. I've been working for about 25 years or so now. I work as an old age psychiatrist in the NHS, so this is really relevant to my day job. Most of my patients are retirement age or older. Many of my patients are 80s, 90s, even in their 100s, so this is really, really relevant. And this is a subject that's coming up pretty much every consultation that I have at the moment. And then I've got a master's degree in medical ethics as well, because this is something that's of interest to me as part of my training. So, yeah, I think probably that's one thing that's going to come through today, is you've got to just question sometimes where you're getting some of your information from. Okay. So I've put an overview there of what I'm going to talk about. I am going to talk about medical ethics, but I think in order to understand the ethics of it, we've got to understand a bit about the illness as well. And some of the questions that have come through already have been about the illness and about the vaccine. So this is what I'm planning to talk about this evening. I'll talk about the virus and the illness. I'll talk about a vaccine. I know some people here have got some science background, but not everybody has. So I'll just go through kind of what a vaccine is and how it works. I'll talk about some of the issues maybe in the vaccine development. There's quite a few myths that are out there at the moment, or ideas that have taken hold, so I'll address some of those. I'll talk specifically about the different types of vaccines that are available at the moment. I said to Billy this wouldn't be a Bible study, but there are some biblical principles that I think we can apply. The Bible doesn't talk about COVID, obviously, or vaccination, but there are biblical principles that help us when we're considering this. Then I'll talk about some ethics, and then there's a list of resources at the end as well for people that want to look into this in more detail. Okay. So first of all, what is the virus? So the virus is called SARS-CoV-2, and that's the virus that causes the illness that we know as COVID-19. The SARS bit stands for severe acute respiratory syndrome. It tends to affect the respiratory system and the lungs, but we're realising it affects much more than that. The COV bit is because it's a coronavirus. If you look at it in a microscope, there's spikes that make it look a bit like a crown, and the V is for virus. And the 2 is because this is the second one that we've come across, and that's quite important when we think about the vaccine, because we weren't starting from scratch when it came to the vaccine development. The COVID-19, the 19 is because it was first identified in Wuhan last year. Not last year, the year before, 2019. Okay. So hopefully everybody knows by now the 3 main symptoms. So if you develop a cough, a fever, loss of smell or taste, you isolate, you book yourself in for a test. But we're finding increasingly there are some other symptoms that can be associated with it as well. So a lot of people will describe muscle aches and feeling, you know, really quite unwell with this, aches throughout their body, shortness of breath, headache. Some people have diarrhea. Fatigue seems to be a very prominent symptom of it as well. And for many of my patients, confusion is very prominent. This is data from Johns Hopkins. This was the data on Monday. Obviously, it's changed even since then. Johns Hopkins is a university in the States that's sort of acknowledged as being a really good authority on collecting data. So global cases now over 95 million. I mean, this is massive. Global deaths over 2 million. UK cases there, 3,405,000. And deaths, this was on Monday, according to Johns Hopkins, was 89,000. Most of the news tonight was about the inauguration, wasn't it? But today was worse than yesterday. Yesterday was the worst day so far in the pandemic. And today, I think it was 1,823 deaths in the UK today. So really, you know, sad statistics that we're dealing with. And it just shows how serious this illness is. Okay. So we're learning about this illness all the time. And I think when it first emerged, we were going on the information that we had at the time. So a lot of us thought, well, maybe it's a bit like the flu. It's maybe not that serious unless you're very frail or very elderly. What we know now, this is data from the World Health Organization, is that about 30% of cases, so 3 in 10 people that have it, don't have any symptoms at all. So obviously that's great for them, they don't feel unwell with it, but it's not so great for the rest of us because they're potentially walking around spreading the virus without knowing that they even have it. A few months ago, quite a few of us at work were tested for antibodies, so that's to test not if you have the virus now, but if you've had the virus previously. And there were quite a few colleagues who tested positive for antibodies who had no idea that they'd had COVID. So about 3 in 10 people, they think at the moment, are asymptomatic. Most people that have COVID will have a mild to moderate illness. Mild is where you just feel pretty awful. You feel like you've got the flu, you're under the weather, you're aching, you're coughing, you've got a fever. Moderate might not sound that bad, but you may still well end up in hospital with a moderate illness. These are folks that develop pneumonia as part of their COVID. 10 to 15% will have a severe illness. This is folks who are needing a lot of oxygen and help in that way in hospital. And then about 5% are critical. So these are the folks that, you know, you've probably seen on the news. They're in intensive care. They've got multi-organ failure. They're very, very severely ill with this virus. And then overall, if you look at mortality, that's how many people are dying of this. In the UK, it's about 1% of cases. But there's a wide variety in that, because if you're in your teens, 20s, 30s, you're very unlikely to die with COVID. If you're in your 80s and 90s, obviously the risk increases significantly. I think, yeah, I've put it there, about 80% of deaths so far, this is stats from America, have been in the over 65 age group, but that means that 20% of deaths have been in younger people. So this isn't just something that's affecting the very old. You know, initially maybe some people thought, well, these are folks who are maybe very severely ill and you know, were probably going to die at some time this year anyway of something. But that's not the case. And the risk of death there, I put as well, it doubles with every 8 years of increasing age. So if you contract COVID at 88, you're twice as likely to die with it than if you're 80, and it keeps going up. And similarly, it goes the other way as well. Many risk factors. Age is certainly the most important one. Underlying health conditions as well. So people that have chest problems, you know, COPD and breathing problems. Obesity is definitely a factor. Diabetes is a factor. Men seem to do worse with this, unfortunately, than women. People from some ethnic backgrounds, certainly in the UK, seem to have a worse outcome. And again, we could spend a lot of time exploring why that might be. It's not just about the illness at the time and death rates, though. There is increasing sort of emphasis on this thing called long COVID as well. So that's people that have symptoms lasting for longer than 12 weeks. So for some people, that's shortness of breath and cough and feeling very fatigued. For other people, some of my patients are having ongoing confusion that just isn't resolving after the COVID is better. It's a wide variety at the moment, and some of these things I think are going to be with us for months and years to come. They're setting up long COVID clinics now in the NHS specifically to look at this. Okay, so a question which crops up quite often is it worse than flu? The short answer to that is yes, it is. Certainly with this new variant that started in sort of London and Kent, it certainly seems to spread more easily. It's more transmissible. It's more deadly. So if you're admitted to hospital with COVID, you, depending on which study you look at, you're between 3 and 5 times more likely to die. And one of the reasons we think is because there's just no pre-existing immunity in the community at all. So many people have been exposed to flu in the past. People have flu vaccines. But prior to January last year, nobody had any immunity to this at all. This is data from the Office of National Statistics. So some people have maybe wondered, well, are these, again, folks that would have just died anyway this last year, and, you know, they may have developed flu and this year they're going to get COVID instead? But the ONS started collecting monthly death records in 1959. And in every year since then, the number of deaths due to influenza and pneumonia in the first 8 months of the year has been lower than the number of COVID deaths. So this isn't just replacing flu like for like. COVID is over and above what we'd normally expect for flu, by far.
So
yeah, go ahead.
So do you see a lot of flu infection?
So when you look back at last year, there were still quite a few flu deaths. It has been lower, and we think that's probably to do with social distancing measures, because the things that seem to help with stopping transmission of COVID are actually probably more effective for stopping flu. But yeah, I'll come on to some more flu data. Yeah. Okay. So this is data that's just come out this week, actually, from the ONS. So this is data for England, and it gets a bit tricky here because some data is for England, some is for England and Wales. These were deaths from last year that were registered by the 9th of January, so it won't have captured all of the deaths yet. But in England, there were 550,238 deaths. They then looked at the five-year average because you would normally expect some fluctuation sort of year on year. So last year, we had 10% more deaths in England than you would expect over and above the five-year average. So 71,110 of those were recorded as being COVID-related. That's different from the figures that the government give out every day. There's been some controversy about that because, as you probably know, the government figures that are released at the press conference is people that have died having tested for COVID in the last 28 days. So, you know, if I've caught COVID and then 27 days later, once I've fully recovered, I get knocked over by a bus, I'll be included in those government figures, even though it's not really COVID that's killed me. These are looking at death certificates. So that's how many. So 12.9% of deaths last year were recorded as being related to COVID. And last year in England, it was the leading cause of death. Bearing in mind that the first death from COVID last year only happened on the 30th of January in this country, so that's really only 11 months of data. Other causes of death last year didn't really drop that much, though, so there were still lots of people being recorded as dying from Alzheimer's disease and cancer and everything else as well. Okay. I'll call out Roger on this one. Roger asked me for some data and how it compares, particularly with certain other causes of death. So this is England and Wales data from last year. So 530,841 deaths last year, and dementia, in 2019, so the year before COVID. That year, dementia was the leading cause of death with 66,424 deaths. That compares with, I was surprised how few road deaths there were actually, but there were 1,752 road deaths in Great Britain. Also asked how many people died with HIV. So this is dying with HIV rather than necessarily dying of HIV, but that was 622. And I've put there, it wasn't 2019, but the worst year recently for flu in England was the 17-18, because flu tends to go from October through to the following spring. So that season we had 22,000 deaths recorded from flu. So you can see that COVID is much higher even than a really bad flu year. Okay, so we'll move on to what is a vaccine. So it's a preventative medicine, and you know, it feels really good when we make people better, but it's an even better feeling if you can stop people from getting ill in the first place. So this is the sort of what we love to do in medicine, really. And vaccines stimulate the body's own immune system to produce antibodies to fight a future infection. So you may well have heard of Edward Jenner. We think of him as the father of vaccinations. This would never have got ethical approval in these, you know, current times. He noticed there was an association, people that worked with cattle in the country and developed something called cowpox didn't tend to get smallpox, and at that time smallpox was a leading cause of death. So I don't know how he did it, but he persuaded someone to let them use their child. He inoculated them with cowpox pustules and they got cowpox. And then once they'd recovered from that, he inoculated them with smallpox. You know, I wouldn't have let someone do that to my child, but the child didn't develop smallpox. So that was kind of, you know, there was some intuitive observation there. And you know, that was kind of how it all started, really. Usually what's given is a weakened version of the pathogen. So the bacteria or the virus or whatever it is weakened or altered in some way. And so we give that to people so that their body can respond to that, can produce an immune response, but not actually develop the illness itself. And there's loads of these vaccinations. Many of us here will have had these as children, so polio and TB, you know, remember queuing up at school for TB. Hepatitis, I had to have that for work. MMR is given to children now. Children have meningitis. Many of us have influenza now. That's advice for all over 50s. the HPV virus, human papillomavirus, that's now given to teenagers in schools to try and prevent cervical cancer. So there's loads of vaccines out there. They're very commonly prescribed. Okay, so I've borrowed this slide from the World Health Organization. It's just to explain how vaccines work. So our cells have proteins on the surface, and when our body, it can recognise what are our cells because of what's on the surface of them, and then it recognises foreign bodies as well, viruses, infections and things. So, I've had chickenpox as a child. My own immune system responded to that. It recognised the surface proteins, it made some antibodies, and now I can't catch chickenpox again from somebody else because I have those antibodies inside me. But when a new pathogen enters this is a new antigen, there is no existing immunity. So the body has to build a specific antibody that can grab onto that surface protein, that antigen, to defeat the pathogen. And this is what's happening with COVID. So nobody has any immunity to, or nobody had any immunity to this. Some people have got immunity now. So the body needs to, and it takes a while for the body to develop that immune response. That's what happens. That's why we become ill, because the body can't immediately pounce on the bug and defeat it straight away. So how do vaccines work? Particularly with the newer types of vaccines, there's a tiny non-dangerous fragment of the organism that includes the part of the antigen that's going to trigger that antibody and that immune response. So we don't give the whole virus because that would make us ill. But they've found that there are certain parts of the virus, certain proteins that can still stimulate the same immune response but without making us ill. It's enough so the body can learn to build a specific antibody, and then if the body encounters the real antigen or bug or whatever you want to call it later on, it already knows how to defeat it. It can get straight on the case, really. Okay. So I'll just come on to a few of the sort of thoughts really about the development that people have had some concerns about and raised some queries about, and there's quite a few myths going around in social media, and we noticed as we came out of Southport tonight there's a big billboard outside of Aldi quoting something about Bill Gates trying to reduce the population, and there's a lot of theories and conspiracy theories out there really. So the first thing I'd just say is the MRHA, so that's the Medicines and Healthcare Regulatory Authority in the UK. They're the body that authorised medicines in this country, and they are, world respected. They are really stringent in their requirements. Nothing has been speeded up, or no corners have been cut in achieving this. And they are bound by professional ethics and just personal integrity, the same as all other doctors would be. So. I think we can have confidence in the MRHA. European Medicines Agency is a similar organisation that obviously governs Europe. The Americans have their own version, other countries have their own version, but the MRHA is kind of world respected. So I think we can have some confidence in that, and we can be thankful for that, because they do scrutinise the medicines that are available and licensed. I'll come on to these other ones individually now. So speed has been an issue for some people. And you may well have heard this, people will say, well, it takes 10 years to produce a vaccine, so how have they done it so quickly? Much of what happens when a new medicine or a new vaccine particularly is being developed is actually not the development of the vaccine at all. It's applying for funding, and it's waiting for someone to get back to you with funding, and it's trying to recruit volunteers, and there's a lot of waiting that goes on in that process. I mentioned before about the fact it was SARS-CoV-2, so that's quite important, because we already knew quite a bit about SARS. Some of you will remember that was an infection in 2003 that started in Hong Kong. Thankfully, less than 1,000 people died with that outbreak, but we already knew quite a lot about the SARS virus and the spike protein, and MERS is Middle Eastern Respiratory Syndrome. That's a similar one as well. There's still odd sporadic cases of that, but thankfully it's not turned into a global pandemic. But we already had quite a lot of scientific knowledge about this virus, or very similar viruses. The Oxford vaccine, I'll come on to this in more detail, but there's a whole group there in Oxford who just, they work in a vaccine centre, the Edward Jenner Centre, and they have been studying Ebola and SARS and all these other infectious diseases, and they were basically just waiting for the next pandemic to come. So they called it Disease X because they didn't know what it was going to be, but they were already developing a potential vaccine, and I'll come on to exactly what that looks like. But again, they weren't starting from scratch. They were pretty much just waiting, you know, for the next thing to come, because unfortunately, as we look back through history, there have been pandemics, you know, every so many years. Sad to say, in a way, but, you know, this illness has affected the whole world, but it's obviously affected rich Western nations. So funding has not been an issue here in the way that if this was just simply affecting some countries in Africa, it may have been more of an issue. So that's quite a sad indictment on our world, but it's nevertheless true that funding hasn't been an issue here. You know, everybody has put so much attention and focus onto finding a cure for this. And there have been lots of willing volunteers as well. So certainly early on in the pandemic, a lot of people wanted to know, how can I help? What can I do to get involved? And people were willing to volunteer when the vaccines were being developed. The next point is quite a technical point, but when you do medical research, you particularly the phase three trials that I'll come on to, you have a placebo group and an active group who are given the active drug, and you give the intervention because you want to see a difference in those two groups, and obviously you hope that the medicine or the vaccine that you're developing is going to show a bigger effect than it would be for the placebo, the group that haven't really had anything at all. If you've got an illness that only happens, you know, once every 5 years or something like that, or very low rates of prevalence, it's going to be very hard to show a difference between those two groups. But there's been so much COVID in this country and in Brazil, where some of the studies were done as well, that it's been actually very easy to show quite a significant difference between the group that received the placebo and the group that received the active vaccine. So that's helped in the development of the vaccine. And the processes of approval have happened in parallel as well. I've got a slide just to demonstrate that. So if we look here at the standard vaccines, normally you do the non-clinical research first, and then you do the phase one trials, and then you probably have to wait for funding, and then you do the next bit, and then you wait for more funding or more volunteers, and then you do the next bit. And then once all of that is done, then you do the scientific evaluation and everything. With the COVID-19 vaccines, what's happened is some of those processes have happened in parallel. So the scientific evaluation of all the phases didn't wait for them to all end and then only then start evaluating it. They've been evaluating it as they've been going through. And here at the bottom as well. I can't get onto that. Ooh. Where it says large-scale production just here. So, you know, normally a drug company isn't going to invest in producing medicines or vaccines until everything's been signed off and they know they're going to make money, basically. That's what they're there for, isn't it? A lot of drug companies have started producing the vaccines at risk. So they've started producing them before all of the data was in, before they've been licensed, so that if they were licensed, they'd have a supply ready to go. Because obviously there's quite a long lead time for developing production lines and everything else. And that's, you know, that's caught at least one of them out, because there's a vaccine in Australia where it's been halted because of other problems that I can talk about later if I need to. But, you know, the drug companies have started developing these, assuming that some of them at least were going to be effective. And our government have done the same thing. They've pre-bought a number of different vaccines, assuming that some of them would be effective. Okay, so safety is a really important thing that we're thinking about, isn't it? And that's why I wanted to just explain how serious the illness was, because even if side effects are quite trivial, if it's not a terribly serious illness, then you're probably not going to expose yourself to it. But we can see how serious an illness it is. So I think it's important to say that every vaccine, every medication will have some side effects. I did plan to bring the side effect leaflet from a packet of paracetamol with me, just so you can see even things that we think of as really benign, that probably most of us would take quite easily, if you actually stop to read the side effects, you know think, oh, because they have to list everything that's been reported. So, you know, we live in the real world. Every medication, every vaccine will have some side effects. even if it's very small, even if they're quite trivial. So we have to acknowledge that. Most of the side effects that we've seen in the studies so far have been very similar to other vaccines. So anyone who's had the flu vaccine or anything else, you know, if you just think about, you've had a jab into a muscle in your arm, you're going to have a sore arm probably for a couple of days. That's to be expected. Some people have developed headache, muscle aches, mild temperature. I'd almost say those aren't really side effects. That's just a sign that the immune system has been stimulated and is working, because that's what happens naturally when we have an infection. That's a sign that our body is fighting the infection. Severe adverse reactions. So they look at everything. When you've had when you're in a medical research trial, anything at all that you develop, you have to kind of record. Severe adverse reactions are very rare, and they're similar to the placebo group. So they give one group basically salt water. So you have to have an injection, and you don't know whether you've had the real one or not, because obviously we can have unconscious bias and we can interpret things in different ways if we were to know. But severe reactions are rare and very similar to the placebo group, and I've got some data actually. In one of the trials, there were more side effects in the placebo group than there were in the vaccine group. I think we need to say as well, though, that there is no long-term data on the vaccine, and I know that's a worry for some people. You know, yes, we don't know in 5 years' time, but we don't know in 5 years' time what COVID is going to do to people either. There is no long-term data yet. But all the data that we know from other vaccines is that if people have any kind of side effects, they usually get them within the first few days. The vaccine doesn't actually stay in your system for very long at all. It's not like a medication that you're taking every day or something like that. So all the safety data that I've seen is very, very reassuring. This has come up, so I thought I'd just address that. This question of, is it a side effect? So, you know, as human beings, our brains look for meaning and for explanation. We naturally tend to make associations with things that have happened. So if someone has a vaccine and then next week something else happens to them, it's always going to be at the back of our mind, isn't it? Did the vaccine cause it? Did the medicine cause it? And what have you. So this is some data from the University of California. And they just said, well, if we vaccinated 10 million people, so we took a really big group of people and we gave them a vaccine that had no side effects whatsoever. So that's basically just the same as saying, well, we're just going to follow up 10 million people and see what happens. If there were no side effects at all, over 4,000 of those people 2 months later would have had a heart attack. Nearly 4,000 would have had a stroke. Some of them will have developed a new diagnosis of cancer. Some of them will have died. That's nothing to do with the vaccine, that's just what we would expect to happen normally. And there has been this report recently that some of you may have seen in the press and in the news about Norwegian care homes. So 33 residents have died in Norwegian care homes recently, and they'd not long, you know, in the recent days before their deaths, they'd had the Pfizer vaccine. So obviously that's raised alarm bells for some people. And the Norwegian Medicines Authority are obviously looking into that. And all of the vaccines at the moment are in something called phase 4 trials. So although they've been signed off, they're still under surveillance. So if there's any side effects, anything like this at all, it will be investigated and logged. Because sometimes side effects can be so rare that we only see them when they're rolled out across a much bigger population. But yes, it's sad that there have been 33 deaths. But the Norwegian medical authority have said, well, under normal circumstances, we would expect about 400 people a week to die in Norwegian care homes. And the fact that they're targeting care home residents early on in the vaccination program, because they are the vulnerable ones, the ones who are most likely to die, therefore, they don't feel that that's particularly unexpected and anything particularly to worry about. So a lot of people who live in care homes, unfortunately, are probably in the last few months or years of their life. They are frail. They have lots of other health problems. They are the older end of the population. So it's sad, but I don't think it's anything that you maybe just wouldn't have expected to have happened naturally. Okay. This has been raised as well about the indemnity scheme and whether that's a cause for concern. So I wasn't even aware of this indemnity scheme, to be honest, but if there is a problem with a vaccine, certainly in this country, you wouldn't sue the drug company. You'd get compensation from the government, and that's caused some people to be concerned maybe about COVID. What people maybe don't realise is actually this is long-standing and widespread. So 24 countries have a very, very similar system, and this has been going on for years. This isn't anything that's new to COVID. And the reason is that vaccines are given to millions and millions of people. So, you know, the Pfizer vaccine's been tested on 44,000. That's a big group that has been tested on. But it will only be when it's rolled out to millions and millions of people that we'll spot if there's a one in a million risk of a certain side effect. And it's likely that when it is rolled out, some people will have allergic reactions, some people might even develop things like seizures. And what this is saying is that, you know, they don't expect the drug companies to compensate people for something as rare as that, that the government would step in and make sure that their citizens were supported. So it's not unusual to the UK. I've just put a list up there. So this is a list of all the vaccines that are covered under this scheme in the UK. This was before COVID, so, you know, I didn't even realise they were still vaccinating against smallpox up until 1971. But this has been going on for a long time. Okay. So some things that are sort of floating around as well on social media and in, you know, comments, questions on some newspapers, so things that people are concerned about, whether the vaccine can actually give you COVID-19. No, it can't. There's two different main types of vaccines at the moment, but neither of them can give you COVID. They don't contain the actual virus. One of them contains just the spike protein. One of them just contains a genetic message. So they don't contain the virus. They're not an altered or a live virus. They can't give it to you. Some people have been particularly worried about the Pfizer vaccine because it's a messenger RNA vaccine, and people think RNA and then they think about DNA and they worry whether it's somehow going to affect our genetic makeup and our DNA. Well, it can't. They're different things. The messenger RNA doesn't go anywhere near our DNA. It doesn't go into the cell nucleus. It's literally a protein that goes into our cells. It's like a post-it note or a message. It does what it needs to do, and then it's gone within 24 hours. It's just broken down as soon as it's done what it needs to do. So it's not affecting our DNA. It can't affect your fertility. I know this has been a concern for some people, so it's not getting into our DNA. It can't be passed on in any way. It's not... When the vaccines first came out, they were advised that pregnant women shouldn't be given them, and they haven't been tested on pregnant women, but that's because a lot of medicines aren't tested on pregnant women because they're pregnant. And we might take risks in testing things on adults that can give informed consent, but we're not going to test it on people who are pregnant. Developing babies are developing very, very rapidly. Their cells are dividing, all kinds of things. So many medicines aren't tested on women, on pregnant women. But some people actually did get pregnant while they were in the vaccine trials, and there's nothing to indicate that there's any impact on fertility. Okay. The vaccine is still advised even if you know you've had COVID-19. So yes, you may have already had it. You should therefore have some naturally occurring antibodies, but we just don't know how long they're going to last. We don't know how many antibodies people have. So the advice is that you should still have it, the vaccine, even if you've already had the illness, because we think that that's going to be longer lasting protection. It's possible, we don't know yet, but it's possible that we'll need to have this vaccine every year. Similar to the flu jab and some other things, it's probably not going to be a one-off that's going to last, you know, for the rest of our lives. And then this is a really important one, and I'll come on to this a bit more, but it doesn't contain any fetal cells. I'll come on to this with when we talk about the development of the vaccines. So because there are some cells that were taken from an aborted baby, that a sort of a version of those, a derivative of those, are used in the production of the vaccine. There are some rumours circulating that there's actually fetal cells in the vaccine. There isn't. There's some rumours going around in some Asian communities as well that there's beef cells or animal cells, things that would be against their religions, and that's not the case either, and there's no alcohol in the vaccine either. So these are the kinds of things that are kind of floating about at the moment that people are concerned about. Okay, so I'm just going to talk now specifically about the Oxford vaccine. This is the Oxford AstraZeneca one. This is probably the one that's more traditional and more like the vaccines that we know of old. So this is an altered adenovirus carrier. This is where it's going to get a bit scientific, Joyce, I'm afraid. The adenovirus is a sort of virus that just gives people a common cold, but it's been altered so that it can't self-replicate, it can't cause us any damage or any illness. And that's the carrier, that's the bit that we're talking about, that was basically waiting to go for the next pandemic. So the Oxford University group had already developed this carrier, this altered adenovirus. And then, talking to Roger about this just before the service, so the scientists in Wuhan, when they realised what was going on, they released the genetic code, the genome, very quickly, which is to their credit. And the Oxford group were able to take that information. They already had some suspicions that the spike protein was probably going to be important from what they already knew from the other illnesses. They focused on that, and they've basically got the genetic code of the spike protein, and they've added that to the adenovirus carrier. So it's really quite clever technology that they've used. When that's given, that then causes an immune response in our bodies to prevent us from future infections. So there were over 11,000 people in the Oxford University phase 3 trials. That's where you have the placebo group and the active group. Efficacy means how effective the vaccine is, and it's thought that's about 70%. There's a bit more to unpick there, though, because one of the groups was about 90%, another group was 62%, depending on which dose was given and the duration of things. But overall, it's about 70%. Just bear in mind that a typical flu vaccine is thought to be about 40 to 50% effective. So even 70% efficacy is actually really good. Okay. AstraZeneca have carried on doing these trials. So there's now been over 20,000 trial subjects. And this is the study I mentioned from The Lancet. So serious adverse events in the vaccine group were 0.7% and serious in the control group were 0.8%. So there were more people that reported side effects after they had the salt water injection than the vaccine.
Yeah. So we say efficacy 7% or whatever. Does that mean 7% of people are protected, or does that mean your protection is 70%? Everybody has about
70%. Yeah, I know what you mean. So that was a question about the efficacy and what 70% means. Yeah. As far as I understand it, that means that the group that had the vaccine, the overall group, was 70% less likely to develop COVID than the group that had the placebo. So it's how it applies to the whole group. And this is one of the things that we're a bit cautious about at the moment. Some people who've had the vaccine are a little bit like, yay, I can go out and do things again, and that's not the case at all. So no vaccine will ever protect completely. And you just don't know whether you're going to be someone who is protected or not. But as a group, because this is data that's applied to a group, so that there's a lot more protection for the group that had the vaccine than the group that didn't. And importantly as well, which I probably should have mentioned, even the people that went on to develop COVID that had had the vaccine, none of them became seriously ill. So this is avoiding hospitalisations and serious illness with COVID, even in the group that did go on to become ill. Okay. One of the good things about the Oxford vaccine is, and you've probably heard this in the news, but it can be stored at normal fridge temperatures. So that's really important in the rollout of the vaccine. The other one has to be stored at very, very cold temperatures, and that's a real sort of rate-limiting step. Even in our country, apparently there are only two places in Wales that can store things at minus 70. But certainly for other parts of the world, that's a real issue. And the Oxford vaccine is much cheaper as well. Even in the UK, it's £3 a dose, which is cheap, but it's being sold at cost to low-income countries. Oxford have given an assurance around that. So, okay. If you're... Yeah, go ahead, Joyce.
Excuse my ignorance, but are you saying that the Oxford vaccine is better than the Pfizer vaccine?
I'm saying it's different.
Come on, be honest.
I've had
the Pfizer one.
Have you had the Pfizer one? The Oxford vaccine, the efficacy, so the effectiveness, doesn't seem to be quite as much as the Pfizer vaccine. So if you're just looking at efficacy, the Pfizer vaccine seems to be better.
Oh,
yeah.
Although I did read a report today from Israel that says it's not as effective as well as effective as they've said.
Yeah.
Is that just because they've done more trial?
I just caught a little tiny bit of that this evening. So I think some of that is because it's real-world data as opposed to trials. And I think it's caused some questions to be asked about how protected you are after just one dose, because obviously our government have changed the dosing schedule now, haven't they? I don't know all the answers to that, because I've literally just read the headline this evening. But, yeah, I think it's probably a little bit like the data you get when you buy a car about your mileage and the data when you're kind of driving in real life. I think there are some similarities there. So vaccines are often, and medicines aren't always quite as effective as you'd think from the medical research. But, yeah, I think, you know, we'll find out, won't we? Certainly, there have been some things that were initially counted as vaccine failures that I don't think are, because, you know, that you're warned, certainly within the first 2 weeks after the vaccine, you know, you've got to be very, very careful. So if someone develops COVID, you know, a day after having their vaccine, they were probably already infected with that, and so you wouldn't expect the vaccine to do anything there anyway. But, yeah, I think as it's rolled out and we get more data, we're going to understand more about it. Yeah, but certainly from the trial data, the Pfizer vaccine looks more effective. Okay, so if you're a visual learner and you like pictures, and I do, so this just explains, this is a slide from the University of Oxford just explaining how the COVID vaccine works. So this the bit at the top where it says number one, the adenovirus is actually the sort of virus that normally affects chimpanzees. As I said, they're modified to make them harmless in humans, and that creates this viral vector. So that was there waiting to go. And then this genetic code, once we'd identified that from COVID-19, the spike protein is taken, it's added to the viral vector, that's what's in the vaccine. And then when the vaccine gets inside our body, it produces this spike protein, that's what prompts the immune response, and that's how our body starts to, you know, is ready basically and waiting to attack the coronavirus if we get infected with it, or we get exposed to it. Okay. Okay, so the Pfizer vaccine now then. So this is kind of new technology, well, relatively new technology. This is an mRNA vaccine. So you probably have heard of DNA. That's inside all of our cells. That's our genetic code. It tells our body what to do, what, you know, that controls the colour of our eyes, all sorts of things. The way it works is DNA unfolds and you get bases that come in. Against the DNA, it's like a template, and what it produces is the messenger RNA. The messenger RNA then tells the cell how to make a protein, basically. The way this vaccine works is that instead of our own cells producing messenger RNA, we're actually injecting messenger RNA into people, so it's like a genetic message, create a spike protein. So there's absolutely no virus at all. There was weakened adenovirus in the other vaccine. There's no virus at all in this one. And it cannot enter our genetic code. Messenger RNA can't do anything to our DNA. It simply doesn't work in that way. So the Pfizer vaccine was a bigger trial, had 44,000 participants. And this one, in the trial data, is 95% effective. That's after two doses. And what's important in this trial is they specifically looked at how it impacted on older people. A lot of medical research doesn't look at older people because they often have other underlying health problems or things that might confuse some of the data. But this trial specifically looked at older people because they are affected by COVID. And the efficacy is still really good in over 65s. And that's important because as we get older, our immune systems don't always function, you know, quite so efficiently. So that's really encouraging data for older folks. The downside with the Pfizer vaccine, or one of the downsides from just this point of view, is the storage. So the messenger RNA is not a stable compound protein, however you want to describe it. So it requires storage at very cold temperatures. And then once it's thawed, you've only got 6 hours to use it. So that's been some of the difficulties with rolling it out sort of across the country. And it's more expensive as well than the Oxford vaccine. In the UK, it's about £15 a dose. And there's no assurances that they're going to try and sell it anywhere at cost. Because I don't think you could, you know, you couldn't sell that to a remote country anyway. They wouldn't have the ability to store it. It would disintegrate. Okay. So another picture there then. So the Pfizer vaccine and how it works. So keep talking about this spike protein. That's the really important part. the scientists have used this to synthesize the messenger RNA sequence, so that's the instruction so that the cells can make the spike protein. That's then wrapped in this lipid, so that's fat, nanoparticles, a little tiny particle of fat that's injected into us. And that's what delivers the instructions to the cell, and the cell makes the spike protein, and then that's the same process again. Our body's immune system responds, and we've got the antibodies just waiting in case we get exposed to coronavirus. Okay. Any questions about those two vaccines?
You said this one here at the minute, that has never ever been used before.
I think it's the first time it's been used as a vaccine. It has been used in some other technologies, so it's been used in some cancer treatments and some other things. It's the first vaccine I'm aware of that's used messenger RNA.
Yeah.
So some people are a bit cautious about it, just from that point of view of, you know, the other is a bit more tried and tested technology, I suppose.
Yeah.
But it's actually really, it's a really smart solution.
Yeah. We don't know what the long-term effects are. It's really an experiment.
It's unlikely that there's going to be long-term effects. As soon as it's done its job and it's coded for the protein, it just disintegrates, it's gone. So it's literally gone within 24 hours. So it's not hanging around in your body. Not that I think it would therefore do any damage if it stayed around longer anyway. There have been real advances recently in malignant melanoma. And some of that is to do with similar types of medicine. So this type of delivery has been used. It just hasn't been used in quite this way with a vaccine. But messenger RNA has been used. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, so certainly everything that we know from applying from other vaccines is it will stop some people getting it altogether. There will still be some people that will still get the illness, but they will have reduced symptoms, so they're less likely to, you know, they keep talking about overwhelming the NHS. So they're less likely to do that. They're less likely to go on to die. Yeah, there are still some people that will get mild illness, so they might still potentially be able to pass it on. But I think that will be, from everything we know about other vaccines, if we apply the same principles, that's likely to be a much smaller group. I think they're probably trying to downplay expectations a little bit to make sure that people don't just go out and mix and think we're back to normal again. I suspect there's some of that. Yeah, okay. So we've got through the science bit. Okay. So just some biblical principles that I felt were relevant and important, maybe just to think about while we think about the ethics. So clearly we know that God cares for human life, and he cares for human life from conception. Roger read a Psalm 139, didn't he, on Sunday? You know, that's very clear in the Bible. So we care about life pre-birth, from conception, right through to the end. You don't know, to natural death, don't we? So that's an important principle. There were so many references to Jesus healing so many people that I've not put any references down there, but you know, you will occasionally meet people who think, well, you know, God is sovereign and what will be, and we don't need medicines and we don't need anything else. And I don't think that's a Christian attitude. God clearly is interested in our suffering, and you know, there's so many examples of healing and of compassion, and we're told to pray for healing, aren't we? I think God's care for the vulnerable is important. I've just put a quote there from Isaiah, but again, we see that throughout the Bible. God's command for us to act justly, to think about the implications of the choices that we make. And then the imperative is there to love our neighbour as ourselves and to think of the interests of others as well. So this isn't just about maybe how it affects me, but it's about how it's affecting other people as well. Okay. So some ethical considerations then. So I'm going to talk now particularly about this use of immortal cell lines that we think were taken from an aborted child back in the 1970s. And this is a real area of concern for many Christians, and I think this is something that we need to consider carefully. when we're thinking about that, one way of thinking about it, to approach it from an ethical point of view, is to think about the fact that we live in a fallen world and how we cooperate with evil in that sense, or how, you know, the sort of limits of how far we go and where our responsibility is and such like. I'll touch mostly on those, and then I'll talk briefly about justice and equity and loving my neighbour as well, and what that looks like. Okay. So immortal cell lines. So there's a bit more science here, but Billy mentioned this in his talk a few weeks ago, and I didn't realise the extent of how these cell lines are used, actually. It surprised me to an extent. So there's a cell line that's known as HEK293. That's human embryonic kidney. So this was taken from a baby that was aborted, they think, in 1973 in the Netherlands. Now, the documentation has been lost. We don't know the circumstances of that. I've read somewhere, well, we don't know if it was a miscarriage or an abortion. I have read that abortion was still illegal in the Netherlands in the 1970s. It only became legalised in the 80s. So it may be that the baby was aborted because the mother's life was in danger, because that was the only reason that you could have a legal abortion at those times. But we don't know, that the records aren't there. Cells were then taken from that baby's kidney. So our organs, even, you know, very, very young embryos and fetuses that are still developing, you know, you can see a heartbeat very, very early on. We have kidneys and eyes and all sorts of things. So kidney cells were taken from that baby for the purposes of medical research. And then those cells were altered. And this particular strain of cells has carried on being used because it's now described as being an immortal cell line. So our cells are constantly dividing, replicating, and then they die, and then, you know, they carry on. And that's part of why we age and we don't live forever, because our cells can't keep on doing that forever. But these cells have been altered and they just keep going. So that makes them really, really useful in medical research. And in a way, that's part of the problem, that they're so useful. Particularly when we're studying medicines and vaccines and things that are going to be used on humans, the best cells to test them on are human cells. There are, you know, you can use yeast cells and you can use chicken egg cells and other things, but it's human cells that give us the best models and the best results. So that's one of the reasons that they're used. So these cells, they give very consistent results. When you're doing a test in medical science, you want to know that it's only the thing that you're testing that's changing and everything else is staying stable, so that you can compare. So these cells enable lots of research to go on with very predictable results, because we know how these cells respond, and they're used very widely. And they're used in some stage in all of the three currently available vaccines. They're also used in many other treatments as well, and as I say, I've been surprised at how many things they're used in. So they're certainly used in MMR, which, you know, many children have had. They're used in other vaccines. If you've had travel abroad and had to have vaccines, you may well have had vaccines that have used these cells. They're used in many cancer treatments, the development of many cancer treatments. So these they aren't being used as the treatment, they're being used in the development of treatments. And non-medical indications as well. So they've actually been used to test artificial sweeteners and a number of other things. So they're very, very widespread. The Oxford vaccine probably has more involvement with these cells. So they've actually been used in the Oxford vaccine in the development and the production of the vaccine. So where I talked about that viral vector and that adenovirus that's the carrier for the spike protein, these human cells are used to generate more adenovirus. So that's how they're used in the Oxford vaccine. They're used to a much lesser extent in the mRNA vaccine, so the Pfizer vaccine and the Moderna one that's been licensed recently. There they've been used in the testing stages, but not so much, well, not in the production and development of the vaccine in the same way. So from an ethical perspective, if this is your overriding concern, there's less involvement with the Pfizer vaccine than there is with the Oxford vaccine. Okay. Just to be really clear, there are no fetal cells in any of the vaccines. If you have an injection, you are not having fetal cells injected into you. And yes, there was an abortion many, you know, nearly 50 years ago now. But no further abortions are taking place in order to keep making more vaccine. So this isn't an ongoing thing, this is a historical thing, a historical concern. Okay. So, I was going to say for pro-life Christians, but actually all Christians should be pro-life, shouldn't we? You know, this creates potentially an ethical dilemma, an issue, doesn't it? So how are we going to deal with that? How are we going to address that? How are we going to respond to that? So that's where we come into this idea of cooperation with evil. So we live in a fallen world, don't we? So many things are tainted with sin and we have to deal with as a result of the fall. So, you know, I was thinking about examples of this. An example that's often given is about our taxes. So, you know, it's right, isn't it? As Christians, we pay taxes to the government. That's what we're told to do. But the government may well do things with our tax money that we don't approve of. So, you know, are we responsible for the choices that the government make with our money? We can't avoid the government. We have to do that. But they are then responsible for the choices that they make. There are quite a few advances that have happened in medicine that have been as a result of some quite dubious events in the past. So, you know, things that were discovered in the Holocaust that have actually helped us to understand how the body, you know, responds to hypothermia. There's actually an anatomy textbook which is really useful to surgeons, but the reason that their drawings are so good and so detailed is because they were done on... they were taken from people that were experimented on in Nazi concentration camps. So again, you know, do you have the good that a surgeon can do by learning from that, or do you say, well, I'm not going to have anything to do with that because of where it originated from? So when we're thinking about that, some of the ways that we can maybe approach that is how close is that cooperation? You know, the person that did the abortion, that's obviously a direct and close cooperation, isn't it? They've actually done that abortion. The scientist who maybe chooses to use those human cells from an embryo rather than some other cells that could be used, that's probably more close cooperation. Somebody who's having a vaccine that's made from a derivative of cells that are great-great-great-great-great-great-granddaughter cells of, you know, cells from 50-something years ago, that's probably more distant. That doesn't mean that that original abortion wasn't wrong, and I don't want anyone to think that I'm pro-abortion, because I'm not. But I think there is some distance there that I think is probably relevant. I think it's important to think about how active or passive our involvement is as well. So, again, I think accepting a vaccine, if you feel that that's the right thing to do, that's a more passive thing, isn't it, than being actively involved in sort of up-to-date research, you know, using these types of cells. I think we have to just think as well, I've covered this a little bit already, about is it perpetuating or encouraging evil? So if there had to be ongoing abortions in order to produce any of the vaccines, I think we'd just clearly say at that point, no, clearly that's not right. Is agreeing to have a vaccine that's used this technology in these cells in their development, is that perpetuating? Is it encouraging evil? Is that our motivation in accepting the virus? And then some kind of slightly more practical questions. So is there an ethical or a more ethical alternative? And will we have a choice? So this is, you know, as I've read around this, Christians, you know, Bible-believing Christians hold different views on this. So for some people, you know, particularly maybe some of the Catholic pro-life groups, they would say, well, actually, any involvement whatsoever, you know, that they just don't feel that they can in clear conscience therefore take a vaccine that's had any involvement. Some people may feel that actually the Pfizer vaccine is a more ethical alternative because there's less involvement with these cells than with the Oxford vaccine. I've read one Christian, though, who feels that because the Oxford vaccine has been developed with the sort of principle in mind of, you know, this needs to be low cost because it needs to get across the world and to the most vulnerable communities and the most vulnerable people. Actually, that's loving my neighbour, and that's the most important ethical principle. So there are, you know, different ways maybe of thinking about it, but realistically, the only choice that we'll have, particularly this year, is have the vaccine or don't have the vaccine. You won't be able to go into the vaccination centre or the doctor and say, actually, I'll have the Pfizer vaccine, thanks very much, or I'll have the Oxford one. You'll be invited for the vaccine. I mean, did it say on your letter, Joyce, do you mind me asking, what vaccine you were going to get? No. You ask them, and they would tell you, because you get an information leaflet, don't you, when you have the vaccine, so you would know before you had it, but I don't think you'd know beforehand when you get your appointment through what you're going to be given. Certainly everyone that had the first wave of vaccine, that Pfizer was the only one that was licensed initially, so that would have been the only one, but now the Oxford one is rolling out and the government have bought a lot more doses of that. I think probably because it's British and because it's cheaper and because it's easier to store and distribute and everything else. So there will be a lot more doses of the Oxford vaccine out there than the Pfizer one. And the Moderna vaccine, which is similar to Pfizer, relatively few doses have been bought of that one. So it's unlikely that you'll get the Moderna vaccine. It may be that in the future, certainly if we have to have these vaccines every year, then it may well be a case of, you know, you can express a preference, or you can explain why you've got a conscientious objection to this. But I think this year, because there simply isn't enough vaccine to go around, and that's supply of the vaccine is the rate limiting step, there won't be the option to choose which vaccine you have. Okay. Any questions about any of that at all? Lisa, go on.
What happened to how you have to have two shots?
Yeah, so the way that the trials were done, you have one shot and then 3 weeks later you have the next shot, and that's where all the research has been. What the government have done is they've said, well, actually they've looked at what happens to people's the amount of protection that you have after one shot, and they've said it's better to have more people having some protection than some people having slightly more protection and other people with no protection at all. All the evidence that's out there said there is some protection after one, not as much as if you'd had two, but there's some protection after one.
They don't work together, or do they?
No, so it's a bit like the second one is really a booster, so you should have the same, if you have the Pfizer the first time, you should have Pfizer the second time, and it's a booster, so it just boosts the effect on the immune system, but it's basically doing the same thing. Yeah, Chris, go ahead.
Yeah, so this cell line came from the abortion in the 1970s. So vaccines have been produced for a lot longer, as we mentioned, in the 1700s, Edward Jenner, and of course after, like Sir Louis Pasteur, were creating vaccines. What methods were they using for the cell lines then, and did that make... Well, the methods that they were using, did that make research for the vaccines more problematic?
I'm not a vaccine expert, but certainly Edward Jenner literally got some pustules and wiped it on people. I mean, that was the kind of level they were doing in the 1700s, so we wouldn't do that now. From how I understand it, older vaccines tended to be what we call attenuated vaccines, so they'd actually take the live vaccine and they'd heat it, or they do something to it, not kind of in terms of genetic engineering, but they'd alter it slightly so that it still produced the same response in our bodies but didn't make us as ill. But there's definitely more risk of becoming ill if you give live vaccine to people than with this kind of more up-to-date version of vaccines that they're giving now. Okay. So I'll just put this is a busy slide and I won't read it all out, but Roger sent this through that Libby had sent to him, and I thought it was really helpful because it's not a case of because something happened 50 years ago or because lots of people might be saved that makes it okay, because it doesn't, does it? The cell line originated in an aborted fetus. This is a tragedy. This is a horrifying wrong that was done. So we can't avoid that. But it doesn't mean that good can't come from that harm. And I think that's probably a good way to think about it. So it talks here about this doctrine of double effect. So, you know, that we can't change that past. We can't bring that child back. But some good can come from that. Yeah, Elise, go ahead.
I remember how most of your colleagues won't have a British vaccine because they don't have a vision view of the body.
True.
So... you know, you, they must think you're a lunatic or something if you don't want to do what they do. You know, does it, I don't know how it would affect you. But,
yeah.
Or how, you must have seen things changing over the years and you, from when you went to college, I don't know. But, you know, and plus being an NHS, like, you just numbers, aren't you?
I mean, I'm certainly not saying that all my colleagues are Christians, because they're not, but there are a lot of Christians that feel called to work in healthcare. So, you know, we're not alone, thankfully. You know, we are protected in some ways. You know, I've consciously objected to going into an abortion when I was a medical student, and I was able to make that clear, and that's very well respected, and that's protected in law. I think a lot of Christians probably don't go into obstetrics and gynaecology because they know that if you don't do it, you're allowed to opt out of it. But then that's creating more work for your colleagues. But there's a lot of Christian GPs that you know, won't prescribe certain contraceptives and won't get involved in the process of referring people for abortion. And we are protected, you know, thankfully we're protected from that in law. So that's a good thing. I think, you know, people that aren't Christians might just think, well, that was a long time ago, you can save lots of people, you know, what's your problem? Probably maybe wouldn't see it in quite the same way as us. We certainly for abortion matters, there's respect for conscience, which I think is really good. Okay. So this quote is saying that, yes, it was a wrong thing, we can't minimise that, but that actually good can still come out of it. Okay, sorry, I'm conscious of time, so I'm just going to skip on. Just very quickly, justice and equity. So this was a bit about implications for low-income countries, and in this country, I'm pleased to see that actually they have given it to older people first, because they are the most vulnerable, they're the people that are going to be most affected by this. So I think that's good that they haven't prioritised other groups, that they've looked at the people that are likely to really suffer with COVID. But in terms of other countries, this is a real worry, because the West are buying up vaccines, and this is at the detriment of other countries and the rest of the world. I don't know practically what we can do about that, but it's just a concern. And loving my neighbour as well. So the benefits of vaccination are not just to us as individuals, but are potentially to the wider society as well. And not everybody can have the vaccine, so it's not licensed for children. Pregnant women, you'd have to do a kind of a risk assessment, really, and sort of weigh up whether you'd want to give it to a pregnant person. You can now if you feel that the risks are sufficient. But people that have got a history of anaphylaxis can't have the Pfizer vaccine. So not everybody can have the vaccine, but the more other people have it, the more that we're protecting the whole community. So that's, you know, one of the considerations, isn't it? How my choice is going to affect other people around me as well. And for many of us, you know, that work in health, that's been a real concern, that we could potentially carry the vaccine into work and infect patients, or I could bring it here and infect people here. You know, that's been a concern for many of us, hasn't it? There has been some talk about herd immunity with the virus. We're nowhere near that. There was a study this week that said probably about 1 in 10 people in the UK have had it. But for measles, you have to have about 95% immunisation to get herd immunity. So, you know, we need high numbers. If only half the population have it, it's not going to be effective. Okay.
What does that mean, herd immunity?
So that's where so many people are immune because they've been vaccinated or they've already got antibodies, that even if somebody develops, in this example, measles, it's not going to cause a widespread outbreak because most of the people that are going to be exposed to it are already immune. Yeah. Okay. Okay, so just some conclusions then quickly. So, you know, it's an important day today from America, aren't we? But we're living in an era of fake news, so just be careful where you're getting information from, because there's a lot of misinformation out there. COVID is a serious illness. All the data that I've seen, I know that people have, you know, concerns, but I would say that all the data that I've seen is that the vaccines are safe and they are effective. And certainly as effective as other vaccines that we give out quite routinely. From an ethical dimension, yeah, there are decisions that we have to make about the vaccine. We've got to think about how we love our neighbours, how we care for the vulnerable. And there are still these concerns, aren't there, about this fetal origin of cell lines using the vaccine. I think this is an area that Christians may disagree on, and I know Christians who feel differently about the vaccines, but I think from a personal point of view, I feel that Christians can accept the vaccine, and I think we should be grateful to God for the speedy development of them. And I think we can do it with a clear conscience, but it is something that we have to pray about and weigh up and you know, take those things on board. Okay, I've gone over time, so I'm sorry about that. This will be on the website, so there's some resources there if you want to read up more about things. If you're not kind of a reading things person, there's a link there to an interview on Christian Premier Radio, which is quite about 7 minutes, which you can listen to. There's some data there as well, and there's that's the details about the individual vaccines that Billy mentioned. I did just mean to mention that there are some other vaccines potentially in the pipeline that don't have any involvement in human cells, but I would say that none of them are anywhere near being licensed, so it's not a case of, well, I'll wait a week and then they're going to be out there, because they're not. Some of them are still at preclinical stages, so they're nowhere near coming onto the market. Okay.